The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
They think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades and never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along and they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria. But thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risk their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attaches from different embassies. To attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
in the limelight.
Google, one of the largest and most influential organizations in the modern world, is filled with ex-CIA agents. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading National Security Search Engine. Google's ranks are filled with CIA agents. Here's the story. Google, one of the largest and most influential organizations in the modern world, is filled with ex-CIA agents. Studying employment websites and databases, MinPress has ascertained that the Silicon Valley giant has recently hired dozens of professionals from the Central Intelligence Agency in recent years. Moreover, an inordinate numbers of these recruits work in highly politically sensitive fields, wielding considerable control over how its products work and what the world sees on its screens and its search results. Chief amongst these is the Trust and Safety Department, whose staff, in the words of then-Google Trust and Safety Vice President Christy Cangallo, decide what content is allowed on our platform. In other words, setting the rules of internet, determining what billions see and what they do not see. Before Google, Cangallo had been President Obama's deputy White House chief of staff for implementation and is currently chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. Many of the team helping Cangallo make calls on what content should be allowed in Google searches and on platforms like YouTube were former CIA employees. For example, Jacqueline Loport spent more than 10 years at the CIA, where she served as a leading U.S. government expert on security challenges in South Asia and the West Asia region and go-to writer of quickly needed papers for the U.S. president. She joined Google in 2017 and is currently a senior intelligence collection and trust safety manager. Between 2010 and 2015, Jeff Lazarus was an economic and political analyst for the CIA. In 2017, he was hired as a policy advisor for trust and safety at Google, where he worked on suppressing extremist content. He moved to Apple in 2021. Ryan Foggett spent 8 years as a CIA officer. Then in 2019, Google convinced him to leave and become a senior manager of trust and safety. As a director of trust and safety, Brian Weisbard led teams that adjudicated the most sensitive YouTube trust and safety escalations globally and enforced the most urgent and highest priority misinformation and sensitive content decisions. Between 2006 and 2010, he was an intelligence officer with the CIA. He is now a director at Facebook. Like Loport and Lazarus, Nick Roseman concentrated on Iraq while he was a CIA analyst. Since January, he has been a senior manager in Google's Trust and Safety Division. Jacob Barrett, Google's global lead for safe browsing operations, was an analytic lead and open source officer at the CIA between 2007 and 2013, and a 12-year CIA political and leadership analyst, Michelle Toworowski, left the agency in 2019 to take a job as the intelligence analyst lead in trust and safety at YouTube. The problem with former CIA agents becoming the arbiters of
what is true and what is false and what should be promoted and what should be deleted is that they cut their teeth at the notorious organization whose job it was to inject lies and false information into the public discourse to further the goals of the national security state. John Stockwell, former head of a CIA task force, explained on camera how his organization infiltrated media departments the world over, created fake newspapers and news agencies, and planted fake news about Washington's enemies. "I had propagandists all over the world," he said. This continues to this day, with the CIA promoting dubious stories about the so-called Havana Syndrome. And all this is to say nothing about the coup attempts on foreign governments, the drug and weapons smuggling, and the worldwide network of black sites where thousands are tortured. Furthermore, many of the ex-CIA employees listed participated in some of the worst crimes against humanity of the 21st century, the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and are clearly proud of it. So while there is admittedly a limited pool of qualified people for roles in cybersecurity, it is wholly inappropriate that Google is employing so many spooks to run their most sensitive, influential operations. And it is especially troubling that so many of the individuals mentioned throughout were plucked directly from the CIA to work at Google, a fact that suggests that either Google is actively recruiting from the intelligence services or that there is some sort of backroom deal between Silicon Valley and the national security state. Elizabeth Murray, a retired intelligence agent who spent 27 years at the CIA and other intelligence organizations, explained how Google might benefit from hiring former spies. "By snagging a CIA employee, a company can save a considerable sum," she told Mint Press, noting that these individuals have been highly trained and likely have a security clearance, something that is exceptionally different to attain in civilian organizations. In terms of benefit to the CIA, a CIA officer could spend several years acquiring a unique set of skills at a social media conglomerate and then return to the agency, paralyzing their newly acquired expertise to the benefit of the agency, Murray added. Even if there is nothing explicitly nefarious about this relationship, it still means that Google will start to think like and see problems the same way as the CIA does. Google has become immensely powerful, transforming itself into a behemoth that dominates online communication, commerce, information gathering, entertainment, and more. But Google is different. You can ignore or choose not to use those other platforms. Google, on the other hand, is far too big to escape from. An inordinate amount of Google's intelligence and security teams appear to come from the intelligence and security services. These include the following individuals: Deborah Witowski, who between 1999 and 2018 rose up the CIA's ranks, becoming chief of staff to the director. She left the agency for Google, where she is now vice president of global intelligence. Chelsea Magnant also left the CIA for Google in 2018, leaving an 8-year career as a political analyst for a job as a global threat analyst for the tech giant. Young Sok Lee spent 22 years at the CIA, leaving to take a position in global risk analysis and global security at Google. In May, he was promoted to become a director, and so many other people in the list. The professional background of so many of his security and risk management staff may go a long way to explaining why Google seems focused on countering threats from official enemy states of the United States. This is despite the fact that the United States is carrying out the largest and most extensive attempt in history to manipulate the internet. A long expose in Newsweek last year detailed how the Pentagon alone fields a clandestine army of at least 60,000 individuals whose job it is to ruthlessly run national security state propaganda campaigns online, calling it the largest undercover force the world has ever known. The expose explained that there are the cutting-edge cyber fighters and intelligence collectors who assume false persons online, employing non-attribution and misattribution techniques to hide the who and the where of their online presence while they search for high-value targets and collect what is called publicly accessible information or even engage in campaigns to influence and manipulate social media. Thus, it is clear that former CIA personnel are deeply embedded within the Silicon Valley giant. Of course, Google is a huge company with thousands of employees. It could therefore be argued that it is unsurprising that some number of former national security state agents work for it, especially those who have the rare and highly developed skills necessary to preside over user privacy and safety. But this tolerance of spooks in the ranks is not applied evenly. Indeed, the very idea seems absurd. Yet dozens of Google employees casually note on public websites that they worked for the CIA and appear to see that as entirely unproblematic. Therefore, this relationship is, at best, inappropriate and, at worst, a U.S. government power play to control cyberspace. Google users frequently say they want more agency over their data, but the only agency they get is the central intelligence kind.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. My third recommendation is the issue of being present among the people. Don't stop doing this. Some people might dramatize it and put labels on it, but I'm not going to repeat these now. Don't get caught up in these things. You may need to figure out how you can use people's thoughts and opinions in different sectors. This needs planning. In many letters that I received in communicating with people, and that such, sometimes I see some suggestions that are very good. A person whom we may not know can sometimes suggest or give their opinion on something. This can be very beneficial at times. Consider how we can make use of these.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
My next recommendation is to keep your promises. Consider this to be an obligation, like your daily prayers. If there is something that you're not sure you can do, don't promise that you will do it. Only make promises that you are certain you can keep, and make sure you fulfill them. In the same way that being among the people and working for them creates hope and trust, not fulfilling your promises does the exact opposite. It causes people to lose hope and even become doubtful about the things that you've accomplished in other fields. This happens when you tell people, we'll do this and that in the city or in this area, but later you may realize you cannot fulfill this promise and you fail to do it. Sometimes certain situations may unexpectedly arise and that prevents you from keeping your promises. In these cases, explain the situation to the people so they can understand. Nonetheless, don't make promises thinking we'll explain to the people whenever we can't keep our promises. This is not your goal. Your goal is to keep your promises, to fulfill them, and to make sure they come about.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has spoken at the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. His speech was directed at the promotion of peace and justice. In the same breath, he slammed countries that promoted this notion, yet in action did the opposite, like the U.S. and its warmongering policies. In this edition of the program, we will look at some of the points that Iran's president has made and why Iran spoke from a position of strength compared to the U.S. when it comes to making a world a better place and a more peaceful place to live in. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Obviously, there's many things that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said during his address at the UNGA, which was his first time there, making the statements in the speech that he made. Let's talk about how he said that Iran was not seeking an atomic weapon. He made sure that something that was known before, that it got highlighted again, and that it was a fatwa coming from Imam Khamenei, and demanded U.S. guarantees that it would abide by any JCPOA sanctions removal deal. Why do you think he repeated that and deemed that to be important to highlight in his speech?
Because the Islamic Republic of Iran has some principles, and unlike the kind of immoral politics that we're used to across the globe, we tend to find that politics is a dirty word, fundamentally, because nobody says what they mean. And the Americans, of course, have demonstrated that within the JCPOA. The Europeans have demonstrated their ill will in that regard during the negotiations with Iran also. But the Islamic Republic of Iran has stuck very solidly to what it said, even though nobody else was abiding by the JCPOA, and the Americans walked out without even a flinch unilaterally. Nonetheless, Iran tried its best for at least a year, if not more, to comply with what was an agreement which effectively had already been made redundant. And since then, it's been a huge amount of patience shown on the part of the Iranian negotiators, the Iranian establishment, to try and keep this JCPOA scenario alive. In reality, you could very strongly argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't need the JCPOA. They've done quite well, thank you very much, through resistance economy, through a greater direction towards the east, the rise of the Eurasian axis, the increasing kind of look away from the West, particularly with this establishment. What you're finding is even less traction than the previous one, where there was a possibility that they were leaning towards the West and overcompensating, trying to really win over the hearts and minds of the Western powers. The truth of the matter is the Western powers want one thing from Iran. They want the absolute annihilation, destruction, and termination of the Islamic Republic's establishment. They don't want the existence of this establishment, unless, of course, tomorrow Ayatollah Khamenei comes along, bends his knee, bows to the neoliberalists and the neocons and the Anglo-American Zionist empire, does everything that Israel wants them to do, hands over the wealth of Iran, and resubjugates its people to the greater money mafias of the world. You know, unless Iran really wants to do that, unless the Iranian public wants that, unless the Iranian establishment wants that, I'm afraid what the alternative is a sort of ongoing enmity and an ongoing guarantee that the West will do its level best to try and destroy Iran.
Elijah Magnier, there were so many things that I could have started out this program with, but I chose that one. And let me see if you agree with me, because I wanted to make an analogy with how Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi talked about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, saying that you have 2% of the world's nuclear activity taking place in Iran, but yet you have 35% of all inspections, ratio-wise, taking place on Iran's civilian nuclear program. And then you compare that with the way that Joe Biden came out when he first started his speech, where he said, we have to defend Ukraine, we got to stand up for them, which all translates into this military conflict prolonging. Is that a correct analogy to make in the way that Iran is promoting peace through the statements that we saw, where that notion and justice was peppered or was sprayed in the Iranian president's statement, as opposed to what Joe Biden was saying?
Well, indeed, it is correct. There is also more I could add to it, is in the last 43 years, Iran never declared war on any country, while the Americans declared war in Afghanistan, on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, on Yemen, and supporting the Saudis in the war in Yemen. So we see that there is no similarity between what Iran is offering to the neighbors and what the Americans are offering to the world. The Americans are only talking now and very busy with their war against Russia and very preoccupied with gathering all the Western forces in country, particularly the EU, behind it, not concerned really what's happening to the, to its allies, because they are the ones suffering. And Iran is saying, I'm ready to abide by the JCPOA if you offer the deal, even if you offer enough guarantees. While the Americans are talking from a position, they are out of the JCPOA. They only offering wars, they offering weapons to Ukraine. They pushing the Europeans to offer more weapons. Nobody here in Europe has any more weapons in their warehouses. So any real war, they are in real trouble. And the Americans are producing more weapons just to send to Ukraine, because it is a Western war against Russia. So they need Iran at the moment, because Iran is their only hope, particularly when President Vladimir Putin announced that he is calling upon a part of reservists and he is willing to continue the war. Now, what the Europeans are going to do without the Russian oil that they are going to start imposing sanction on the 5th of December? Of course, they have Iran, they have Venezuela, and with both countries, there are sanctions imposed by the U.S. and particularly by the U.S., and nobody else dares to make business with Iran, particularly the EU, who did not, as your guest rightly said, abide by the agreement of the JCPOA and did not do any step to respect their deal and their part of the deal. So what we have today is a country that the U.S. is leading the world, but is leading the world toward more wars and more destructions. And Iran is saying, I can help you, but give me the enough insurance to return to the JCPOA, but I'm still in, but I will abide by it if you show the real intention that you are trustworthy. And sure. There is no point in Iran talking at the UN General Assembly, because a quarter of the world there are pro-US, and the two other two-thirds of the world is really not against the US, but not with the US, and preferring to stay either on the side or on the side of Iran.
Right. Well, I'm wondering how those people reacted, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, and how maybe you reacted also, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, when we heard Ebrahim Raisi speaking, and he was speaking about some of the issues that we're going to hopefully get to in this program, like unilateralism and the way that the U.S. has gained political leverage through controlling institutions over other countries. And then all of a sudden, when he starts talking about martyred General Qasem Soleimani and brings up a placard of him at the podium there at the UN General Assembly for the world to see that it was the U.S. that assassinated this general that was at the forefront of eradicating terrorists from the region and even beyond. What impression did you get from that? And what do you think people thought, that this was the U.S. that did it? And here you have Ebrahim Raisi raising that point.
Well, I think it's interesting that Raisi went for the humanitarian card. I mean, it's usually a weapon that often the West tries to use against Iran by inventing all sorts of bloated arguments about how despotic Iran is. I mean, of course, that's what's pumped out by most of the Western media, Western propaganda. Most Westerners haven't been to Iran for decades, if ever at all. So a lot of this propaganda can stick. But for Iran to take hold of that particular issue and to raise Haji Qasem Soleimani's placard is very significant, because what Iran is pointing to is that this region, as long as it has the American interference in the way they are prepared to interfere, you know, with their industrial military complex, with their sort of color revolutions, with their supporting of despotic, illegitimate leaders around the Gulf states, with their support of the Mossad and of Israel's Odin Yinon plan to expand across the whole of the Middle East. How on earth can you possibly have peace? The likes of Haji Qasem Soleimani, who were killed, not even in action. He was killed as a diplomat, traveling on the invitation of the Iraqi government, and the Americans didn't even respect that. What this shows is that the American regime has dropped so low that they actually don't really respect any international law. There is no rule of law that they really respect. So human rights violations, I think this is where Ibrahim Raisi was trying to hit, was that, look, do you really want a world where we have one bully, one unilateral bullying power that makes everybody do exactly what it wants. It is okay to plunder, rape, pillage, destroy, kill, murder, maim by their own admission. Don't forget, Mike Pompeo was very, very famously on air admitting that they steal, plunder, and do all sorts of other murderous acts, and they do it gleefully. And this is what the CIA's job is, etc. It's the job of the Mossad. It's the job of the MI6. So when you're faced with a force which knows no morality, which knows no real human rights, but touts democracy and human rights as its major reason for being in West Asia, exposing them with what they did to Qasem Soleimani is symbolic of what they've been doing against the Yemenis, against the Syrians, against the Libyans, the devastation, the ruin, the destruction they leave behind when they don't get their own way, and the theft of the gold and the oil and whatnot. Well, that's de rigueur. Whether they destroy a nation or not, they're going to steal those anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think the plea to the world, even though as my colleague rightly pointed out, the plea to the world goes almost on deaf ears, because most of these nations are puppets or fear economic sanctions from America. And again, that terrorism of an economic kind, the psychological warfare terrorism that they engage in, the manipulation behind the scenes, these are all part of a war which Iran has been at the front line of against America ever since 1979. And now, of course, the Russians and all sorts of the Chinese as well, perhaps, are going to be gradually embroiled by the absolutely psychotic behavior of the Anglo-Zionist American empire.
So what I'm curious about, Elijah Magnier, is that when you sift through and dissect what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, and then you try to look for things there that maybe are weak at any sense of the word in terms of what he's trying to present, and this is not to just compare Iran's President's statement to the U.S. statement, it seems like Iran and Raisi, on behalf of Iran, were speaking on a position of strength, because what he was saying was, in essence, a world that should be void of all these different injustices and negativity that's being pursued and then executed by the U.S. And he named some examples. Did you get that feeling at all in terms of the way that Iran has conducted itself vis-a-vis the U.S.?
I get this impression from the first day Raisi was nominated the president. So we've seen the Americans were playing a bit cool, thinking that Iran is going to rush to ask, please return to the JCPOA negotiation. We saw how Raisi waited for 5 months before starting the negotiation. That's one. Two, the Iranian negotiator refused to have the U.S. flag in the room where the negotiation was conducted with the Europeans on behalf of the Americans, and never accepted a direct meeting or direct negotiation with the Americans. The three, we see that today when Iran is saying, I want to prove that you're going to stay in the JCPOA, and you're not going just to sign the deal, and then after that you start imposing sanctions under different reasons that are really a way for the U.S. to reimpose more sanctions. So we see Iran, had Iran wanted to sign the JCPOA, it would have been signed months ago or even a year ago. But Iran is looking after the interest of the Iranian population by saying either we sign a good deal or no deal at all. But at the same time, Iran is sending a message to the world saying, even if I don't sign the deal and I am still in the JCPOA agreement, it doesn't mean that I'm going to go and make a bomb, although I have the knowledge to do it because I've reached 60%. I have all the advanced centrifuge of the 8th and 9th generation, and I can do it whenever I want. It's not up to you to decide if I do the bomb or not, because I will do it if I want to, but I don't want to. So this is a position of strength. At the United Nations, Raisi is talking from a position of strength, is aware what the world is going through, and saying, I am not signing the deal, although the Iranian negotiator is here in the UN, ready to negotiate, but I'm not going to sign any deal. That is a position of strength.
Sure. Well, the U.S. has always tried to alienate Iran, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, and I believe through one of the statements that our guest there, Elijah Magnier, said before, that I recall, he said that Iran is going into this General Assembly from a position of strength, coming high off of the SCO summit that was held in Uzbekistan. And there, when you have Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi in the presence of world leaders speak and be present there, then you can't be isolated. Now, the thing is, and I'm curious about this, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, do you think that there are many countries who would like to take this stance against, not just against the U.S., but to push back against some of the U.S. ways and methods that it has used and speak up against it like Iran has done, but they're afraid to do that because they might be subject to U.S. focus, whether it's sanctions or foreign policy?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the overwhelming majority of nations in the world are deep down sick and tired of American bullying and threats. I mean, that's how they essentially operate their empire. They threaten people through, as I mentioned, color revolutions, economic threats, through military threat. They have done this for decades, of course, and now they're masters at it. But the time is running out, because what we're seeing increasingly now is the confidence of the likes of China and Russia and Iran, three of the major economic powers, now beginning to talk about moving away from the dollar. This never happened before. They're talking about creating new means of trading with each other, away from the SWIFT banking system. There's talk of opening up that $5 billion credit line which Russia wants to offer Iran. The Chinese are not worried about sanctions when they're doing deals with Iran, Iraq, and others, going into the multi-millions around building the Belt and Road Initiative. All of this basically is saying to the Americans, look, you can't have it all your own way. A multipolar world is a much better place, rather than the kind of dictatorial unipolar world that you've been dreaming of. And I think that that's where the world is heading. The Eurasian axis, I believe, is an inevitability. The Americans are making it an inevitability by really scoring own goal after own goal. They could have a softer policy towards Iran or Russia. They could share the cake. But the trouble is they've got so greedy, and had it so their own way for so long, that they really are drunk on the using military means and other means and their other cunning tactics to see if they can coerce, scare, and co-opt people into doing what they want. And all these other powers are saying, you can see China's policy. They tend to do fair deals. They don't go in and invade countries. They crack deals and they stick to those deals. They offer fair recompense in terms of building infrastructures of nations where they get resources. You could argue the wrongs and rights of that, but nonetheless, they're not imperialists in that formal sense of just raping and looting and installing leaders that they think will be conforming. So there's this rival power, or a series of rival powers, which are now coming up, and they will challenge America, and it will create a world that will be in flux for a considerable time yet.
Sure. Well, this world order, that's a new world order, was expressed by the Iranian president, Elijah Magnier, in a few different ways. One of them was through denouncing unilateralism, in which Raisi said that American foreign policy, he said over the past century, had actually proven that the unilateralistic approach that the U.S. had actually pursued was at the self-interest and at the expense of partnerships. Do you think countries like, say, Mohsen Abbas said, don't speak up, but they really are sick and tired of it, and they perhaps are the ones that Raisi are talking about, that they feel that way?
I fully agree with Mohsen Abbas. What he said is really the truth, and this is the reality today. And we've seen that in the meeting during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where half of the world population representative and leaders were present to talk about the exchange with their goods and trade with local currency, and they were outside the U.S. orbit. Yes, indeed, the U.S. is challenged in its unilateralism. It's still strong. We should not think that the U.S. is not going to defend itself and is not going to cause more harm and to be more harsh than it is today, because it's going to defend its throne and its position worldwide. And to do that is going to cause more damage to the world, and it is causing it, mainly to its allies in Europe and in Africa and other people who are in need of support, particularly in Afghanistan, confiscating $9 billion, etc. So yes, the U.S. is going to defend its unilateralism, but it is challenged and is no longer going to hold for very long.
Last point that time allows us to make, say, Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking at the point that the U.S. President Joe Biden made on the use of veto power, where he said that countries should refrain from the use of this veto power. I'm wondering, when he says that, doesn't he realize then why does the U.S. use that veto power when it comes to Israel?
Well, the double standards are laughable, aren't they? This is what Aga Raisi talked about, the double standards of these Western powers. And they know it, but this, of course, they get away with murder because they can. And literally, by supporting Israel and doing what they did in terms of planting that kind of cuckoo in the nest in the Middle East, what they've done is they've perpetuated a war and a conflict which would never have been there. I mean, take Israel out of the equation there, and the odds are that you really wouldn't have the kind of turmoil and chaos and conflict. That's all created fundamentally and deliberately by the money mafias who wanted the oil and Israel to sit there as their policeman, and they continue to be hell-bent on doing that. Islamic Republic of Iran was the first to stand up genuinely in a real way. Yes, you had Jamal Abdel Nasser and all the previous wars that were kicked off, but in reality, the first constructive and really long-standing opposition to the tyranny of Zionism and Anglo-American Zionism has come from Iran. That makes it another target, and I don't think Iran is not going to let go of that. They're going to demand justice for the oppressed, and not least of all for their own people in Iran.
Thank you so much, Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ecovacs.